This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On this Memorial Day, we remember the human cost of our wars, most recently the more than 1,800 Americans killed in the service of their country in Afghanistan and Iraq. The places and the numbers change, but every one of those lives resonates with their buddies in the service and back here at home, at high schools and colleges, in small towns and city neighborhoods, with families and friends.
He was born a G.I. Joe. Along with the books and the art and the music, he was also always a soldier.
I've had people, you know, when I first got back, say, man, you're a hero. I said, no, we left the heroes over there. They're dead. I said, we're just survivors, that's all.
As he walked up the stairs to get onto the plane, and he turned and he waved to us, that was the last time that we saw our father.
She had a lot of life in her and a lot of goals and hopes, and it's sad that she will never get to see him.
If you heard boom, boom, you just run. Grab your gear. If you have it near you, you don't run to a bunker. Jesse always made sure that I was okay, made sure everybody in our squad was okay. He cared for everyone.
You just heard Terry Clifton, mother of Lance Corporal Chad Clifton, killed in Iraq this year, Fred Lane, a veteran of the Korean War, David Everett, who lost his father in Vietnam, Louis Lau, whose sister, Army Private Karina Lau, was killed in the current war in Iraq, and finally Private First Class Jasper Duran, friend of Private First Class Jesse Meisner, who was killed in Iraq in 2004. In just a moment, we'll speak with a father about how the loss of his son affected his family and hear from the mayor of a town in Pennsylvania which has lost two men in Iraq. We'll also talk with military historian Victor Davis Hansen about how the nation as a whole either tolerated or resisted loss of life in previous wars. Later in the program, the lilting sounds of the Aloha Boys will join us with some Hawaiian music from Studio 4A. But first, the war dead. If you're a family member or a friend who's lost someone in war, tell us how it's changed you. How did it affect you think about war? How does the casualty count affect your willingness to support American military efforts? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now by phone from his home in Midlothian, Virginia, is Richard Lynn. His son Carl was stationed in Iraq and killed in January. I can't begin, especially on Memorial Day. The word sounds so meaningless, but we all, such condolences for your loss.
Thank you. Thank you. Don't quite know what to say.
Yeah, I know. How did you hear the news that your son was dead?
Well, actually, they tried a different number. Carl had left both our number and his grandmother's number, and someone tried to just get a fix on an address.
Mm-hmm.
And so actually, what with caller ID and all, my mother put two and two together and called me. I was on a business trip about an hour from town. And you know, when people need to speak to you face to face, you just know what it is. Nobody will tell you anything because they have to do it face to face.
How has your family coped in the months since?
Well, it's been difficult. I mean, thank God there's just a lot of good people out there. Everybody's by our side. And, you know, the first couple of weeks went by, didn't even have time to think because of everybody being with you. I don't know that the shock or anything has really even worn off, at least for me. Just still seems kind of unreal. That, well, you know, maybe you will get home one of these days, you know, that sort of thing. It just hasn't even quite sunk in yet, I guess.
Did Carl have brothers and sisters?
Yes, he has a younger brother who just turned 16.
How has this affected him, do you think?
Well, it's not much on the surface, but you can tell there's a lot of undercurrents there. He really looked up to his brother, and he has his own opinions of, you know, his own worldview, and trying to piece that together, it's a difficult thing at any age, let alone that age.
Yeah, 16's tough. I wonder, what did you think about the war before your son died?
I don't know that I had, you know, a lot of thoughts one way or the other. I mean, I was always interested. I always followed things, not not to say, well, they should or should not do this. You know, there's a lot more to it than meets the eye. I felt that, you know, something needed to be done in general. Now, whether that's the right way to do it, that's beyond me at this point in time.
And then with a son in the Marine Corps, did you follow the news in the war more closely?
Oh yes, absolutely. We had an inkling. We knew almost 8 months or so, or a year before he deployed, that it was a good possibility. So as things ramped up, I just took a closer and closer view, to the point of checking the news and the DOD reports and everything two or three or four times a day.
Sure. And after he was killed, have you thought again?
Well, I think if anything, I'm probably more in support of it, if nothing else, because we are where we are. Never mind how it started or what mistakes we've made in the past, but, today is today and tomorrow is tomorrow. You know, you always have to look at where you are now and where you're going. And not just to honor those that have fallen, but to look at ourselves as a nation and say, hey, what have we started here? We do have to finish it or bring it to some kind of conclusion. We can't just walk away or say we're tired of it. That just sends the wrong message to the rest of the world.
What would you tell Carl's brother if he decided to sign up?
I tell him I respect his decision. Like with Carl, he was very influenced by the events on 9/11, and he wanted to have me co-sign when he was 17. I said, well, there's time. Just, give it till you're 18. But when he came 18, he was still adamant, and I said, fine, I'm fully supportive of that. I admired he wanted to pay society back for the opportunities he'd been given.
Were there ceremonies today?
Yes, they had. We went up to Culpeper National Cemetery, where Carl was buried, right next to my father, who was in the Navy. And they had a little ceremony there, just a general ceremony, and it was quite by accident. I didn't realize that they were going to have that, but it was very, very touching.
Richard Lynn, thank you so much for sharing your story. We know it's a tough day for you.
Thank you.
Richard Lynn is the father of Marine Lance Corporal Carl Lynn, who was killed in Iraq earlier this year, and he was kind enough to join us by phone from Midlothian in Virginia. We'd like to hear your calls this hour, your reflections. If you've lost someone in war, how has it affected you, your family, your town, your school, and your country? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Let's talk with David, and David's calling from St. Louis, Missouri. Hello, David? David, are you there? I guess David has left us. There we go. And let's try Adam. Adam's in Pembroke Pines in Florida. Adam, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Adam. You're on the air. Go ahead.
How are you doing today?
I'm very well, thank you.
My aunt, Andy, had a fiancé that she lost in Vietnam. And to this day, it's affected her, and it's overflowed into the family because she still, I guess, pines for him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of weird me trying to relate to her because I've only lost, friends in wars. Like, in the Gulf War, I lost a couple of friends. And as far as her losing a fiancé, every year on, the day she found out that he had died over there, she calls me. We've always been really close. She's been, more like a second mother to me than an aunt. You know, whenever she has a problem, she calls me or I call her. And it just brings a real somber mood into the family when she starts talking about him. I mean, she still has his picture up by his bed. And I just don't know how to relate to her and her loss because, Vietnam was a much different war than what's going on today. I believe it was more controversial. And it's just, the way she still, after 30 years, it's still affecting her, a war that happened, in 1963 to 75.
Just about. A living memory then.
Yeah, and it's and you know, it's almost every time you talk to her, she'll bring his name up. And it's just, you know, it gets to be hard on me because I really, like I said, don't know how to relate to that as far as losing a loved one like that, other than just friends that I've had that have died in, you know, in the Gulf War and in Kuwait. And it was just, it's just a lot different.
Did you stop to remember them today?
Yes, I did talk to her today. And she brought him up just as usual. You know, and today she's got her flag out and the scratching from the Vietnam Wall that she had made, like the etching.
Mm-hmm.
She's got his name right underneath it, you know, framed outside. And it's just like, you know, she keeps like wondering what would have been. And I guess that might affect a lot of people, you know, that have lost a loved one like that in any war.
Sure. I wonder, your friends, though, the ones you said were killed in the first Gulf War, did you stop to remember them today?
Yes, I did. I went out and hung a flag, and I didn't, you know, and that's another thing I'm not seeing. I remember as a child, you know, growing up during the Vietnam War, I mean, Memorial Day would come around, and every house would have a flag out. Now I'm looking around my neighborhood, and I'm one of two in the whole neighborhood that's actually showing, you know, their appreciation for those who have, you know, died to let us be free.
Well, Adam, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Memorial Day started after the Civil War as a time set aside to decorate the graves of the war dead. In the century and a half since, conflicts around the globe have added to the names we honor. Today we stop to remember the fallen, including the most recent losses, the more than 1,800 servicemen and women killed in Operations Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom. You're invited to join our discussion. Has the casualty count in this conflict changed your support for the war one way or the other? Did it have an effect on your views in earlier conflicts? Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address totn@npr.org. Many of the men and women who died in Iraq and Afghanistan came from smaller, often rural communities. James Urich is the mayor of Shamokin, Pennsylvania, a town of roughly 8,000 residents. Recently, Shamokin lost two young men who were stationed in Iraq. James Urich joins us now by phone from his home in Shamokin. Thanks very much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Tell us a little bit about your town. Is the military an attractive option for young people there?
Well, we're a small coal city. At one time when coal was king, we were flourishing. But since then, our economy certainly has dwindled. And a lot of the young people that leave high school, instead of going on to college right away, do enter the military.
Now, you've lost two men in Iraq, Matthew Sandry and Robert Sheets. As the mayor of a small town, I wonder, did you know them?
Well, first of all, Sergeant Sandry's family lives directly across City Hall. Captain Sheets, his father was involved in the Shamokin School District. I knew both families, and the families are pillars of our communities.
So how does their death affect a town like yours?
Well, you know, coming from a small community, we know each other. It's not like living in a large city where you don't know the person next door. We know everyone, basically, maybe not by name, but by face across the entire community. So it's very devastating to lose two fine young men.
Because you could just think about what if.
That's true. In testimony to their sacrifice yesterday in Shamokin, we had a ceremony to dedicate a brand new flagpole in front of City Hall, which a bronze plaque will be placed very shortly in their memory.
I suspect that near that flagpole there are memorials to men your town lost in the Civil War and World War One, World War Two, Korea.
Right down the street from City Hall, we have memorials from the Civil War on. Every major conflict, and their names are, and all our heroes are inscribed in them halls.
What's Memorial Day like in your town?
Well, actually, it started yesterday with a very very positive turnout from our communities. Not only from Shamokin, but surrounding communities. And I assume we had maybe 200 people that turned out at every branch of the service there yesterday in support of the dedication of this flagpole. And again, this morning we had a parade and then a memorial service that our local veterans group put on every year. We're a very patriotic community.
And that being said, I wonder, has the loss of these two men changed at all your thinking about the war?
Well, first of all, I've listened to your broadcast, and I really appreciate the father who lost a son, and I can appreciate his willingness to continue to end this conflict. Personally, and this is my own belief, I think we set out as a mission as our government. I stood behind our president. I don't totally support the president of what's going on now, but I really believe that I support our troops and I support what they believe in, but I think it's time for our troops to come home.
James Yurick, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
James Yurick, the mayor of Shamokin, Pennsylvania, joined us by phone from his home there. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Melissa. Melissa's with us from Clarksville, Tennessee.
Hi. First of all, I wanted to send out my condolences to all the families that have lost loved ones, especially recently in Afghanistan and Iraq. I'm currently serving on active duty with the 101st Airborne in Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and I've been to both Afghanistan and Iraq. My job is to identify and process the soldiers that are killed. So I kind of have a unique perspective on the casualties of war and how it affects families. And it's amazing to me how strong these families still are after having lost a loved one and how supportive they still are of what's going on over there for the most part and how much they support the troops. I think it's absolutely amazing, and my heart goes out to them, especially today.
There is an organization of families of those killed who oppose the war, but that's not to say they're not honoring the troops.
Right, right. And a majority of them, even if they don't support why we're over there or, you know, the reason for fighting over there, they still support our troops, which I think after having lost someone has got to be extremely difficult.
I could only imagine. Dealing with them, again, this resilience is what impresses you?
I'm sorry?
The resilience of these families is what impresses you?
How strong they are and how they just have such passion and such heart. One of the soldiers that was killed early on in the war in Iraq when I was over there, I had processed his remains. And a year later, I had a chance to meet with his mother and his father. And, you know, they embraced me and they hugged me and they took me in as part of their family. And they were just, it was just amazing how strong they still are after having lost their son.
Melissa, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. To get a bigger picture of how the country has responded to its war dead during past conflicts, we turn now to military historian and classicist Victor Davis Hanson, a fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University and the author of many books. He's with us by phone from his farm in Selma, California. Nice to talk with you again, Victor.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
How has the American response to war fatalities changed over time, do you think?
I think in the modern age, when we have the advantages of technology and we're living much longer, that we almost assume that people are going to live to 80. And besides that, we don't have much experience with killing our own beef or preparing our food or that tragic, brutal side of life that was characteristic of civilization until the post-industrial age. So it's getting harder and harder for Americans to think that anybody should have to die so young when we have the technology to keep us all alive and the education, the sophistication to keep that side of that brutal side of our existence distant from us. So when we see a suicide bomber or a beheader or we see people, it's just harder and harder the more sophisticated and affluent we get.
It's interesting. A lot of people would say that we see so much virtual death on television and the movies and that sort of thing that has numbed us to the reality. You think just the opposite?
I do. I think that's a vicarious experience for most people. They seek that animal desire for violence, perhaps, just because it's not in our own experience every day. And it makes it even more unusual that people in the United States in the military are willing, in this very sophisticated, as I said, leisured society, willing to take on that burden, especially when unlike the Civil War, where we lost over 600,000 dead, or World War II with 400,000 plus, it's not so immediate, even though in some ways the danger to the security of the United States has never been greater with the advent of nuclear weapons and terrorist bombs and asymmetrical warfare. But still, it's hard for people not to see a Union. When you don't see a Union army or a Confederate army coming over the hill,
mm-hmm.
or you don't see a Japanese submarine off the coast, then it's harder. These become more abstract sacrifices, and it's harder for people to, who conduct war, to communicate that to the American people, who themselves don't really necessarily think life is so tragic as it was 100 years ago.
I wonder, during the war in Vietnam, there were tens of thousands of Americans dead before public opinion began to really turn on the question of the war. In Iraq, that has gone much more quickly.
Yeah, I think it has. I think it has. I think that we're up to 1,600 actual combat deaths or plus, perhaps.
In Iraq itself, 1,800 with Afghanistan.
Yeah, I don't know how many of those were actually in combat, but I think it's you're pretty close. And I think that as we see that, the threshold is getting much smaller. Even though at 9/11, which whether one agrees or not, the relationship with these wars, nevertheless, that was the worst attack in our history, and it was much more a precursor to reactive warfare than was true in Vietnam or even Korea. So I think it, as the United States matures, it's getting harder and harder to justify losing anybody for these causes, even though in some ways, as I said earlier, the United States' security is more jeopardized than it ever has been. I don't think that in our wildest imagination, the Nazis or the Japanese could have taken out a skyscraper in New York City.
Hasn't the American public, though, always been reluctant to send young men and women into harm's way? For example, the Second World War, the dangers from Japan and Germany were evident, yet it took the second worst attack in the nation's history, Pearl Harbor, to bring the United States into the war.
I think it's true of democracies in general, and the United States in particular, that we're very, very slow to galvanize, that if you look in the Civil War, there was no public opinion in the North really to fight that war. Lincoln had a real hard problem mobilizing public opinion, not just to let the Confederates be. World War One, we stayed out almost 3 years. World War Two, public opinion was overwhelmingly against entering the war before Pearl Harbor. So, yet that being said, once Americans galvanize themselves and they feel that a war is in their national interest, then they make enormous sacrifices. We've lost more people. We lost more people in Okinawa in a week than we did in this three-year war. And if you go back and look at campaigns like Iwo Jima or Sugarloaf Hill in Okinawa, the amount of carnage and sacrifice and brutality is amazing. And yet the American people were able to get through that and think that it was justified. Those were just terrible battles.
Yet Americans did tolerate them. The shock of those war tallies from those islands in the Pacific, because I think they understood, had a good understanding of what the war was about, what its purpose was, what was going on in Vietnam and this conflict too. It has to be said, there is less clear purpose.
I think so, because part of it is we're seeing asymmetrical insurgencies where people understand that after World War II. And after the rise of the United States in the post-war period as a superpower, that it's not very wise to fight the United States conventionally. So we don't see a traditional battlefield with tanks on either side and planes where the whole strength of the American arsenal can be put into play. Rather, that we see people who blend in with civilians, or they use explosive devices, or they engage in assassinations, or they use psychological warfare to hurt the morale of the United States. And these wars are always fought in very strange landscapes and far distant from the United States. And all of these criteria make it harder and harder to equate in the American mind, when one young person dies like that tragically, how that is connected with the safety and the security of 300 million people. And it's very strange, because when this country was less than 100 million people, it lost 600,000 in 4 years in the Civil War, and yet in some ways 300 million people feel the loss of 1,800 people much more grievously in some ways. So I think it's part of the symptoms of modernism, and I think the military is aware of it. I think the political establishment is aware of it, and whatever one's feelings are on the war, the casualties and the cost now become central to it in a way that perhaps wasn't true in the 19th century or the early 20th century.
Victor Davis Hanson, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Victor Davis Hanson, a classicist and a military historian. He's now at the Hoover Institute in Stanford and joined us by phone from his family farm in Selma, California. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get some more listeners on the line. We'll talk with Mary now. Mary's calling from Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I was calling because this is the first war during which I'm actually older than those who are dying, and it has been really disturbing and traumatic for me. I'm only 27, but to see how young the people are, like their faces on TV and their families and stories, and I just, it's really hard to get my mind around that there are 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds that are out there and dying. And I just, it's so hard. Yeah, I mean, and I'm not, I don't have anybody that I know that's there. But it has a deep impact on me because I think I'm young, but they're really young.
Mary, it's difficult. Thank you. Appreciate the phone call.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye. And let's talk now with Dean, and Dean's calling from Tallahassee in Florida.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon, Dean. You're on the air.
I'd like to make a comment following up on what your historian said, for one thing. And that is that I think that in today's political climate, it's very difficult to characterize the nature of the conflict that we're in right now. If you're as old as I am, you remember the Crusade in Europe, and you remember the last good war. But the conflict that we're in today, unlike Vietnam, which was an incredible national disaster. But the war we're in today has got some real issues involved with it. And we are in an incredible conflict with a group of people that really don't like us. And their intent is to hurt us as badly as they can, both physically and economically, politically. They view us as a dark force, and we need to understand the nature of this conflict. I have two sons, both of whom are on active duty right now, and I'm very proud of their service. They're prior service people. They were called back up with their guard unit, but we're in a situation where we're in this for a long time. And the nature of asymmetrical warfare is such that we're going to be in this conflict for a lot of years. It's not going to be easily won, and we're not going to have islands that we can claim as we jump across the Pacific to measure our progress, or cities that we take in Europe to measure our progress. This is going to be a very difficult conflict, but it is real. And the dangers involved with it are incredible.
And, Dean, we just have a few seconds, but obviously with two sons and on active duty at the moment, this could become terribly, terribly real at any minute for you.
Oh, it's you can believe me. It's real.
Dean, thank you. Go ahead. We have time for a short comment.
Well, no, I am proud of them. I would be incredibly disturbed if one of them lost their life in this conflict. But, you know, there's some things that are worth living and dying for. And we're a very blessed country that we've had young men and women who've stepped up over our national history and have made those sacrifices.
Dean, thank you so much for the call. When we come back from a short break, the Aloha Boys join us for a tour of traditional and modern Hawaiian music. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after the break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.